A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
The first time I had a wing source that wasn't just heat. I remember the sting arriving late. The burn built slowly, wrapped in something almost buttery, and it coated the tongue instead of just attacking it. I sat there thinking, oh, this was made by someone who actually wanted me to taste something. Daniel's been thinking about the same thing. He's been working through a bottle of Melinda's ghost pepper wing sauce, and noticed what makes it work isn't the Scoville count, it's mouthfeel. It's a rounded flavor profile. It's heat that delivers something beyond pain. And he's got three questions for us. When did Kraft hot sauce actually become a thing? What separates a truly great sauce from a Scoville bomb? And which brands have built real followings over the years? So today we're going to trace the arc from pepper mash to pantry staple and figure out how a condiment became a craft.
Let's start with the numbers, because the size of this market might surprise you. The global hot sauce industry is worth over $4 billion now. That's the Institute of Food Technologists figure from last year. But that headline number hides the structural shift that actually matters. The segment growing fastest isn't Tabasco or Frank's Red Hot or the mass market bottles your dad's had in the fridge since 1993. It's the premium and craft tier. Small batch producers, single varietal pepper sauces, fermented mash, fruit purees, the stuff that sells for $12 to $18 a bottle instead of $3.99.
$4 billion for spicy vinegar.
And most of that growth is coming from people who've decided that heat alone isn't the point. So let's define what we mean by craft hot sauce operationally, because the term gets thrown around loosely. I'd say it's three things. First, small batch production. We're not talking about a contract manufacturer running 50,000 gallons through a continuous pasteurizer. Second, emphasis on ingredient sourcing. Specific pepper varietals grown in specific places, fruit purees, fermented bases that take weeks or months to develop, and third, a philosophy where heat is a component of flavor, not the point. The heat is there to carry the other flavors, not to be the only thing you notice.
Which is the opposite of the old model, where heat was the differentiator and everything else was an afterthought.
And I'm thinking of sauces like Da Bomb, which is basically capsaicin extract in a bottle. It's a novelty. It exists so someone can film themselves crying on YouTube. Nobody's drizzling Da Bomb on their eggs because the flavor is. Well, there isn't one. It's just pain. And for a long time, that was the market logic. Make it hotter, put a scary name on it, sell it to college students.
The hot sauce equivalent of a haunted house. You walk through, you get startled, you leave. Nobody moves in.
That's the frame. So what changed? The inflection point for craft hot sauce is roughly 2015 to 2017, and it's not one thing, it's three forces that hit at the same time. The first is what I'd call the super hot pepper arms race. The Carolina Reaper was certified as the world's hottest pepper in 2013 by Guinness, clocking in at over 1.5 million Scoville units on average. Then Pepper X comes along in 2017, pushing past 3 million. And at that point, you've got a ceiling problem. Once sauces are hitting 2 million Scoville units, more heat becomes meaningless. Nobody can taste anything at that level except capsaicin. So the arms race burns itself out, and makers start asking a different question. What else can we do with these peppers?
The heat ceiling forced the flavor conversation.
Right. And that's where the second force comes in, the broader craft food movement. Craft beer had already trained consumers to think about hot varietals and fermentation profiles and IBUs. Craft coffee taught people to care about single origin beans and roast dates. Craft chocolate did the same thing with cacao percentages and terroir. By the time hot sauce got there, the consumer was ready. They already knew how to be curious about what was in the bottle.
And the third force?
Distribution. Hot sauce festivals, online communities, the subreddit for hot sauce has hundreds of thousands of subscribers, and YouTube review channels. All of a sudden, a small maker in Portland or Austin could reach an audience without getting on a supermarket shelf. The festival circuit became this traveling bazaar where you could taste 30 sauces in an afternoon and buy bottles directly from the person who fermented the peppers.
So you've got a heat ceiling that makes pure Scoville, chasing pointless, a consumer base that's been trained by craft beer and coffee to care about provenance, and a distribution channel that lets tiny producers find an audience. That's a pretty clean recipe.
The Guardian ran a piece in December 2022 that captures this shift perfectly. They profiled a maker in the UK who talks about fermentation time, pepper provenance, and vinegar profiles the way a sommelier talks about oak and tannins. The direct quote from the article is, "It's pretty much like profiling wine." And that's not pretentious, it's accurate. A sauce made with peppers from a specific farm in Sainte-Saëns-Woude. Augustine, fermented for 6 months, finished with apple cider vinegar from a specific orchard, tastes different from a sauce made with commodity cayenne and distilled white vinegar. Those differences are real and they're detectable.
The Business Insider piece from this year adds another layer to this. They point out that the ultra-spicy pepper revolution didn't just create novelty, it forced the industry to evolve. Once you could buy a sauce that was pure capsaicin extract, the market split. On one side, extract gimmicks, sauces that exist to be a dare. On the other, craft flavor, first sauces. And the craft side won, because the gimmick side has a one-time customer, and the craft side has people who go through a bottle a month.
And that brings us to Daniel's observation about Melinda's, specifically about mouthfeel. This is the part where the chemistry actually matters, and it's the part most people miss when they're thinking about what makes a sauce great.
Walk me through it. What's happening when a sauce feels rounded instead of sharp?
Capsaicin is fat soluble. It dissolves in oil and butter and egg yolk, not in water. When you make a sauce that's just pepper mash and vinegar, which is what most traditional Louisiana-style sauces are, the capsaicin hits your tongue immediately and aggressively. There's nothing to slow it down. Your mouth is mostly water, so the capsaicin doesn't really dissolve, it just sits there burning. But when you emulsify the sauce, when you create a stable mixture of fat and water, everything changes. The capsaicin dissolves into the fat droplets, and those droplets are suspended throughout the sauce. When you eat it, the fat carries the capsaicin deeper into the food matrix, and it releases more slowly. You get that rounded, building sensation instead of an immediate spike. The heat arrives, but it doesn't ambush you.
So Melinda's Ghost Pepper Wing Sauce works because it's an emulsion, not just pepper mash and vinegar.
That's exactly what's happening. Wing sauces are typically butter-based or oil-based emulsions. The fat does two things. It carries the capsaicin and it coats the mouth, which further modulates the heat release. You're tasting the pepper flavor, the garlic, the acidity, and then the heat builds underneath all of that. It's layered. A vinegar-based ghost pepper sauce would just be a punch in the face.
The butter is doing the same work that the fat in a good curry does. It's a delivery system.
And this is where the craft philosophy becomes tangible. A mass market sauce doesn't think about delivery systems. It thinks about shelf stability, ingredient cost, and hitting a target Scoville number. A craft sauce thinks about how the capsaicin gets from the bottle to your tongue and what happens during that journey. That's the difference between a sauce that's hot and a sauce that's good.
So once you understand that the best sauces are about flavor architecture, not just heat, the question becomes, who actually does it well?
Let's build a canon. Daniel mentioned Melinda's, and that's the right place to start. But the backstory matters, because it explains a lot about how the craft movement developed.
The trademark dispute.
Right. So in the 1990s, a woman named Marie Sharp in Belize started making a habanero-based hot sauce using local carrots as a base. She called it Melinda's, and it was one of the first habanero sauces to get real distribution in the United States. But she had a U.S. distributor who trademarked the name out from under her. She lost the rights to her own brand name. She eventually relaunched as Marie Sharp's, which is still around and still excellent, and the Melinda's brand continued under different ownership.
That's brutal.
It is. But here's what's interesting for our purposes. Melinda succeeded in the craft era because they built a ladder of heat levels within a consistent flavor philosophy. The Ghost Pepper Wing sauce is the star, but the whole line works because they use carrot and habanero as a base. Carrot adds natural sweetness and body. It thickens the sauce without needing gums or starches, and it rounds out the sharp edges of the pepper. You can go from their mild sauce all the way up to the ghost pepper, and the flavor DNA is consistent. That's brand discipline.
So the carrot isn't filler. It's structural.
It's doing the same work that roasted tomatoes do in a different sauce. Which brings us to Secret Aardvark. Portland-based, built a cult following through what I'd call a habanero forward, Caribbean adjacent profile. Their key innovation was using roasted tomatoes and carrots to create body without relying on oil. It's a different mouthfeel strategy than Melinda's. Less buttery, more, I want to say jammy, but that's not quite right. Substantial. It has weight. You can put it on a breakfast taco and it stays where you put it.
And the flavor profile.
Habanero forward, but with enough roasted tomato sweetness that you're not just tasting capsaicin. There's depth. It's the kind of sauce where you find yourself putting it on things that don't normally get hot sauce, because it's doing more than adding heat. It's adding a whole flavor layer.
You mentioned Austin.
Yellowbird. This is a different strategy entirely. Yellowbird pioneered what I'd call the sriracha replacement niche. Sriracha had this moment in the 2000s where it was on every table in every kitchen, and then people started looking for alternatives, something with a cleaner, brighter flavor profile. Yellowbird sauces use no sugar, more vinegar, and they're more pepper-forward than traditional sriracha. The serrano and jalapeno versions especially taste like the pepper first and the sauce second.
And they scaled.
They scaled without losing quality, which is the hard part. A lot of craft brands hit a wall when they try to move from farmers markets to national distribution. Yellowbird managed it. They're in Whole Foods, they're in Target, and the product in the bottle is still the product that built the following. That's rare.
What about the extreme end? You mentioned that extract gimmicks lost to craft, but some craft sauces still go for serious heat.
Torchbearer sauces is the best example. Their zombie apocalypse sauce uses ghost peppers and scorpion peppers. We're talking well over a million Scoville units, but they balance it with garlic and onion. A lot of garlic. Enough that you can actually taste something besides the fire. It's proof of the thesis, even at extreme heat levels, the best sauces are about flavor architecture. Zombie apocalypse is brutally hot, but it's not a gimmick. It's a sauce you might actually cook with.
The garlic and onion are doing more than flavor, though. They're adding allium compounds that interact with the capsaicin receptors in a different way. There's some evidence that alliums modulate the perception of heat.
I'm not sure about the receptor-level mechanism, but anecdotally, it tracks. A sauce that's just peppers and vinegar feels hotter than a sauce with the same Scoville count that's loaded with garlic and onion. The alliums give your palate something else to pay attention to.
So we've got four different strategies for building body and delivering heat. Melinda's uses fat-based emulsion plus carrot. Secret Aardvark uses roasted vegetables for a jammy texture. Yellowbird goes bright and vinegar forward with a cleaner pepper profile. Torchbearer uses alliums to create a flavor scaffold that supports extreme heat. None of them are just peppers and vinegar.
And that diversity of approach is what makes the craft movement interesting. It's not one thing. It's a set of solutions to the same problem. How do you make something that's hot and also good?
There's a knock-on effect here that's worth pulling out. The IFTP's from last year notes that the startup ecosystem for hot sauce is unusually accessible compared to other food businesses. The barrier to entry is low. You need peppers, a fermentation setup, bottles, and labels. You don't need a commercial kitchen to start. A lot of makers begin in their home kitchens, move to shared commercial spaces, and scale from there.
And that created a virtuous cycle. More makers means more variety. More variety means more consumer education. People learn to distinguish between a vinegar bomb and a fermented sauce, between extract heat and whole pepper heat. More education means more demand for the good stuff, and more demand pulls more makers in.
The pepper gardening connection is part of this too. A lot of craft sauce makers started as hobbyists, growing their own peppers. You grow six varieties of super hots in your backyard. You got more peppers than you can possibly eat. Fresh, so you start fermenting. You give bottles to friends. Friends tell you it's good. Suddenly, you're at the farmer's market with a folding table and a cooler.
That's the origin story for probably half the brands on the market right now. And it matters because those makers have an intuitive understanding of their ingredients that you don't get from buying commodity pepper mash by the drum. They know what a specific pepper varietal tastes like at different stages of ripeness. They know how fermentation time changes the flavor. They're not food scientists. Well, some of them become food scientists, but they're starting from a place of deep ingredient knowledge.
So, if a listener wants to evaluate a hot sauce the way we've been talking about it, what's the framework? What are the axes?
Three dimensions. First, Heat delivery mechanism. Is it extract, whole pepper, or fermented mash? Extract is a red flag. It's going to be one-dimensional heat with no pepper flavor. Whole pepper means you're getting the full flavor profile of the pepper itself. Fermented mash adds complexity. The fermentation process develops lactic acid and umami compounds that you can't get any other way. Second, fat and emulsion strategy. Is it butter-based, oil-based, or vegetable pulp-based? Butter-based sauces, like Melinda's wing sauce, are going to be rich in coating. Oil-based sauces tend to be sharper, with the heat hitting faster. Vegetable pulp-based sauces. Secret aardvark Marie Sharps get their body from the produce itself, which means the mouthfeel is lighter, but the flavor is more complex. Third, acid profile. Is it vinegar-forward, citrus-forward, or fermented lactic acid? Vinegar-forward is the Louisiana tradition. Sharp, clean, cuts through fat. Citrus-forward is common in Caribbean-style sauces. Brighter, more aromatic. Fermented lactic acid is what you get from a long ferment. It's sour in a softer, rounder way, like sauerkraut or kimchi.
And those three axes interact. A butter-based sauce with a vinegar-forward acid profile is going to taste completely different from a vegetable pulp-based sauce with fermented lactic acid, even if they use the same peppers.
That's the craft. It's not just about what peppers you use, it's about the whole architecture.
I want to go back to something you said about Melinda's, the carrot base. That's a Marie Sharps innovation originally, right? The Belizean style uses carrot for sweetness and body.
Yes. Marie Sharps is still made in Belize, still uses the original recipe with carrots and habaneros. The flavor is distinct. It's fruitier than most habanero sauces, with a sweetness that comes from the carrots rather than added sugar. If you've only had the Melinda's version, the Marie Sharps original is worth seeking out. It's the same DNA, but it's, I don't want to say better, but it's the original. There's a clarity to it.
The trademark dispute created two parallel lineages from the same recipe.
Which is kind of a perfect metaphor for the craft movement as a whole. It started with someone in Belize making sauce in her kitchen, and now there are two successful brands, plus hundreds of others, all tracing back to the same insight. Heat needs a carrier. It needs something to ride on.
The carrot was the carrier before the butter was.
And that's the thing about Kraft hot sauce that's genuinely new. For most of the 20th century, hot sauce meant one thing: peppers, vinegar, salt, maybe some garlic, the Louisiana style, Tabasco, Crystal, Louisiana brand, that was the template. And it's a good template. Those sauces are excellent at what they do. But they do one thing. The Kraft movement said, what if hot sauce could do 50 different things?
The monoculture broke.
And it broke fast. 2015 to 2025, the number of hot sauce brands in the U.S. went from a few dozen to, I don't have an exact number, but it's in the thousands. The hot sauce festival circuit alone, there are major festivals in New York, Chicago, Austin, Portland, Albuquerque. Each one has 100+ vendors, and those are just the ones that show up to festivals.
Some of those vendors are going to be terrible.
Oh, absolutely. For every yellow bird, there are 10 guys who grew some ghost peppers, fermented them for 3 days, and bottled the result with a funny label. The low barrier to entry is a feature, but it's also a problem. It means there's a lot of mediocre sauce out there. But that's true of every craft movement. For every great craft brewery, there are 50 that are just fine. The market sorts it out eventually.
The funny label is the tell, usually. If the label is working harder than the sauce, you're in trouble.
The other tell is the ingredient list. If you see capsaicin extract or oleoresin capsicum, put it back. That's not a hot sauce, it's a chemistry experiment. If you see aged peppers or fermented mash near the top, you're probably in good shape. And if you see specific pepper varietals, not just habanero, but red Savina habanero or chocolate habanero, that's a maker who cares about flavor.
The specificity is the signal.
It's the same signal as single origin coffee or a wine label that names the vineyard. It says this ingredient matters, and we want you to know which one it is.
So where does this go? The craft beer comparison is instructive and a little worrying. Craft beer went from a fragmented movement of small brewers to a market where the biggest craft brands got acquired by macro brewers. And now there's this weird macro craft tier that's neither small nor mass market. Is hot sauce heading the same way?
I think the acquisition pressure is real. Melinda's is already distributed nationally. They're not a tiny operation anymore. Yellowbird is in major retail. Once you're in every Whole Foods in the country, you're a target for a larger food company looking to buy growth in the premium tier. McCormick owns Frank's Red Hot. They could absolutely decide they want a Kraft brand in their portfolio. But the barrier to entry on the production side is so low that even if the big players consolidate the middle, new makers will keep popping up at the bottom. You can't consolidate a market where anyone with a fermentation crock and a farmer's market booth can enter. The craft beer comparison breaks down because brewing beer requires serious equipment and real estate. Making hot sauce doesn't.
The next frontier might be functional sauces. Probiotics from fermentation marketed as gut health products. Or cuisine-specific sauces. Not just Asian style, but a sauce designed specifically for Sichuan cooking, with flower peppers and dabanjiang. The craft movement is still young enough that the categories haven't all been defined yet.
The Sichuan thing is interesting. Sichuan peppercorns produce a different kind of sensation. It's not capsaicin heat, it's hydroxy-alpha-sansual, which creates a numbing, buzzing sensation. A craft sauce that combined that with actual chili heat would be doing something new. I don't know of anyone who's nailed that yet.
Someone's fermenting it in a crock right now.
Probably. The other frontier is terroir. We are already seeing sauces that name the farm where the peppers were grown. As the market gets more sophisticated, I think we'll see the same thing that happened with wine and coffee. Specific growing regions developing reputations. Hatch Valley peppers already have this. There's no reason a sauce made with peppers from a specific volcanic soil in St. Augustine couldn't command a premium the way a single-origin coffee does.
Daniel's observation about Melinda's mouthfeel is exactly the kind of thing that only comes from paying attention. He noticed that the sauce wasn't just hot. It had texture. It had body. It coated the tongue in a way that changed how the heat arrived. That's the whole show, really. Once you notice that, you can't go back to the stuff that's just pepper mash and vinegar.
You can't untaste it.
Nope.
But of course, theory is one thing. Production is another.
I hand-labeled bottles for a summer at a place called Burning Brook, upstate New York. Small batch operation, 5 sauces, all fermented. The owner was a purist, refused to use xanthan gum, said it was unnatural. Every single sauce separated in the bottle. You'd pick one up off the table, and there'd be a half inch of clear vinegar floating on top of the pepper sludge. Customers had to shake it for 90 seconds before they could use it. I agree with everything you've said about mouthfeel, but I think you're underselling consistency. Physical consistency. A sauce that separates on the shelf makes people angry before they even taste it. It doesn't matter how good your fermentation is if the bottle looks like a failed science project. Melinda's works partly because it stays emulsified. That's not just chemistry, that's craft discipline. Burning Brook went under in 2018. The flavor was good, the texture was a mess, the owner blamed the market, I blame the lack of xanthan gum.
How much xanthan gum are we talking?
For a thin sauce, you'd add about 0.1 to 0.3% by weight. It's a tiny amount. It just keeps the particles suspended.
He wouldn't do it. He also tried to make a ghost pepper maple syrup one season, crystallized into a solid block in the fridge. We had to chip pieces off with a knife.
Do you still have a bottle?
I kept one. It's still solid.
Maple syrup crystallizes when the sugar concentration gets too high and the temperature drops. Adding pepper mash would have introduced nucleation sites. It was never going to stay liquid.
I told him that. He said the customers would appreciate the authenticity.
Did they?
They appreciated not buying it.
The thing about xanthan gum is that it's produced by fermentation. It's a bacterial polysaccharide. It's arguably more natural than a lot of things people accept without thinking about it. But the word gum scares people.
He used to say, "Would your grandmother recognize this ingredient?" I said my grandmother wouldn't recognize a ghost pepper either, but here we are.
The grandmother test is a terrible test. My grandmother thought sloths invented pizza.
Nobody believes that.
Doesn't make it less true.
The pizza thing aside, Hilbert's point about consistency is important because it's the part of craft that's invisible when it's done right. You don't notice a well-emulsified sauce, you just use it. But when the emulsion breaks, it's the only thing you notice.
The maple syrup story is going to stick with me. A solid block of ghost pepper sugar.
It's in a box in my closet. I don't know why I kept it. Seemed wrong to throw it away.
You're waiting for the right recipe.
I'm waiting for nothing. It's a brick.
So where does this all go? That's the question we're left with. The craft hot sauce market is still young enough that the categories aren't settled, the acquisition wave hasn't fully hit, and the next innovation. Whether it's Sichuan-numbing heat hybrids or terroir-driven single-farm sauces is probably fermenting in someone's crock right now. Daniel's observation about mouthfeel is exactly right, and it's the kind of thing you only notice when you stop treating hot sauce as a dare and start treating it as food.
And if you're standing in front of a shelf of bottles trying to pick one, you've now got a framework. Skip the extract. Look for whole peppers or fermented mash. Check the fat strategy, butter, oil, or vegetable pulp, and the acid profile. The best sauces aren't the hottest. They're the ones where the heat has something to ride on.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flemingtop, who once again has a story we didn't know we needed.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed the episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com or email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.